In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
So, well, let's start with one question to Manuel, because we chatted about that a couple of days ago. And do you think that we are already in the middle of an international cyber war? We are hearing more and more about hacker attacks on companies, on critical infrastructure. And you, as someone who is an expert in securing those infrastructures and consulting people in doing that, helping them to secure those infrastructures, what would you say?
Well, cyber war is a populistic wording which is not reality, because you cannot do a war in the cyber area or cyber space. So that is more a political opportunity discussion. Well, it sounds like some big thing, a war, and we have to fight against it. In reality, it's some kind of hybrid warfare or information warfare, that state actors are, well, at the end, disrupting democracy by acting like organized crime gangs, by misusing, for example, vulnerabilities to protect us, and using state trojans such as Pegasus or mass surveillance like using Palantir to be able to do some kind of cyber war. In reality, it's more like finding out information about the other ones. And it's not in war times usually, but more in non-war times. And if you have a war already, like in Ukraine or in Israel, well, you use, of course, a cyber dimension in the war, but then you have already a real war. And the cyber dimension is one part of the war. But at the end, it does not matter if it's a cyber war or whatever. It's a real war killing people. And the cyber dimension is used to have an information, some positive outcome of information. And that is, in reality, the scenario. You have non-war environments usually, and you use the tax money from civilians for solutions made by, like, well, I could say a fascist like Peter Thiel, or from Israel companies like NSO Group, and German companies like Gamma with Finn Fischer, which is not helpful for democracies, for civilians, for the economy, and even for critical infrastructures. But that is not the discussion if people are discussing about, well, we have a cyber war and we have to fight and we have to do offensive things. That's not the thing we really need to protect democracy, civilians, and critical infrastructure.
So, Kai, we already had your CEO on stage yesterday, and we talked a lot about sustainability. And when we think of Airbus, we are thinking about planes, we are thinking about rockets, all those things, basically stuff that is flying. What is the part when it comes to, or what are you doing in connected intelligence? What would be like a classic product in that category?
That's a very good question. Well, it's more what we just heard about. It's more about software. It's more about cybersecurity, what we actually do. So everything that is in our company considered not to fly, because it's only zeros and ones, I think they fly. But really the protection, also the support of the military to see where do we, and he rightly said, you know, there is nothing like an cyber war. But every time before a war, you noticed that people try to penetrate your system. They try to find the weakest link. How do you get in? How can you get information, disinformation? You know, put out things that are not true to the troops, or find where's your weak spot? How can you do that? And that is where we try to have something for the armed forces, also for police. and rescue teams, so the blue forces, to really be up on their best foot, that nothing gets in their communication. So we have something like public safety and security exactly for that, that wherever there is help needed, help can actually get to.
Robert, you're in Austin, Texas, so in the US, and there's an election coming up this year. And we all hope that it's not going to be Trump in the end. But when we are talking about protecting democracy, then we also have to talk about how can we protect electoral systems and everything that is connected to that. Would you say that, we already heard that the term cyber war is a bit misleading, but would you say it already starts at protecting democratic systems and processes?
Yeah, I do think the term cyber war is a bit heavy-handed. It elucidates sort of some sense that if someone does X, that we are at war. But generally, when we're at war, there is a kinetic component. I think it's more like what was happening in the Cold War. In fact, I refer to this as Cold War II, where there's a lot of, you know, espionage. It happens in whatever way it happens. Some people get killed along the way. That is a thing that happens in espionage. But mostly it's pretty cold, and things are getting destroyed or ruined, or data is being transferred that shouldn't be transferred or whatever. And in any Cold War, I would expect there to be hotbeds of activity, for instance, things like elections, if there's any sort of massive campaign of things that need to sway a vote in one direction or another that's favorable to the opposing party. Anything that can be leveraged by the opponent is an area that you might see an attack in the kind of overhanded stated sense, but also just think of it just as influence. I mean, they need a certain amount of influence in government. They need it and with people who drive local policy, not just like in national policy or international policy. You might run into situations where they need businessmen to make certain decisions to allow them to purchase certain things or allow themselves to divest in really interesting ways or have access to things that they shouldn't have access to in other ways. So I think that's really more the way to think about it. It's more this low rumble of Cold War activity that you're seeing, and it's heating up. I mean, it's the idea of a Cold War is you prepare for a hot war. And that is where the bombs start dropping and the missiles start flying. And proxy wars like Ukraine and what's happening in, frankly, Iran is really more of a proxy war. I think that is sort of a precursor to a real war and feeling everybody out and seeing everyone's weapon systems ahead of time, getting access to the things they need to have access to and so on.
We talked a lot about technology also yesterday. When we look at the big trends that are coming up technology-wise, we often talk about artificial intelligence, we talk about quantum computing. Manuel, would you say that they have an impact on that whole topic when it comes to securing infrastructure, when it comes to securing democratic processes and everything that is linked to that?
Well, most people think that it is technologies like cyber attacks in like you see in the cyber or in the science fiction movies. It's like by hacking, misusing vulnerabilities, having information advantage, hacking everything, and now new with AI jumbawamba. What we have is technologies like active cyber defense, or call it whatever you want, at the end, offensive methods to compromise digital infrastructures and critical infrastructures to have that advantage. What we also have in as a problem in democracies is disinformation methods. What we have also such like from Israeli Team Yorke or American Cambridge Analytica, which is problematic, but we also have this on China or Russia, so everyone is doing this disinformation as propaganda, which is an old military methodology, is always in cold or hot war and in every kind of place in the world used as much as possible. So mainly it is in reality something like in non-war times, it's more like surveillance technologies, like I said already, Palantir, state trojans like Pegasus and Finfisher, and breaking into critical infrastructures, getting informations and being able to disrupt them, endangering the collateral damage scenario, what we also see in Ukraine and Gaza, and not only in the past when WikiLeaks leaked the collateral damage video, for example. So we have also these technologies as a dual use and misused by calling it active cyber defense or whatever. That's a problem.
And what would you say is your biggest challenge in your job right now?
Ooh, that's a big one. I think dual use was mentioned. That is one part. And in my business, we also do constellations. So anything when, you know, satellites for Earth observation, but also, of course, for, you know, looking into zones where, you know, maybe fires might start. And getting that information down to the ground is one of the parts where actually you can do misuse. You can change a picture easily. And I think every one of us has seen the Pope in this big suit. You know, that was not true. So you can do a lot with that. So you have to know that the picture is real. And how do you transport it? You need to have some expert for that. Otherwise, I'm not allowed to send a picture across to you, whoever wants to have it. We have a system called One Atlas, where you can actually task a satellite and get an image, but you have to be registered. You cannot just come and say, I want to have a picture of the White House. So, and do some misuse of that. Or I want to have this airport over there. So, that is where we notice a lot more, you know, requests by also sources or people that, you have to find out who is behind that. So we have to protect our customers, but also ourselves. That is one. But, the other one we're also looking at is, probably some of you have heard about FCAS. The you know, the new combat system kind of, and just finding out how is a mission being flown with drones, with fighter jets, that in the event of where you this information is broken or the connectivity is broken, this is also where, you know, your enemies will probably try to attack, that you can still do your mission. And that is critical, of course, for the armed forces to connect to land, sea, space, air, and be cyber resilient. So that is, in a nutshell, you have to be mastering all the domains at once. And it's more and more getting, you know, an intrusion by people trying to find out what you're doing and how to, you know, get to the assets of the others.
Right. So it sounds like it's getting more and more complex out there. And we've got all kinds of different sources of threats. Are we actually fast enough to avoid a successful attack?
Definitely not. In fact, some of the software that I developed just as a test, it was called Strangelove. And the idea was a fully automated one-day tool as opposed to zero-day tool, where you take existing attacks and you reverse engineer them, put your own payload into them. You have an existing target list. You feed that target list and you compare it to what the exploit is. You decide what things are likely to get compromised by it. You turn it around, you fire it back at them. And that entire process, everything I just said there, takes 0.02 seconds. In fact, it's so fast, I ended up having to get rid of the command and control infrastructure for it and make it fully standalone, totally autonomous, because I was running into speed of light issues between here in Austin and in Northern California. And so that time frame, 0.02 seconds, is, you know, that's 10 times faster than you can blink your eye. And the problem with that is if I want to patch a box, like if I get the exploit at the exact same time I get the patch and I have to decide which one's going to make it through first, just the time it takes to log into a system, like to pass log and D, is about 0.1 second. So that's almost an order of magnitude slower than it takes to exploit it. And then the time it takes to type in like sudo apt update, semicolon sudo apt dash y upgrade, that's like 5 to 10 seconds. And the time it takes to run the patching updates, if assuming they're already available inside the update mechanisms for like Ubuntu, let's say, that's, you know, on average run another 10 seconds. So we're talking like 20 seconds. That's multiple orders of magnitude slower than it takes to exploit that same machine. So the disadvantage the companies have is they often don't really spend the time to understand their attack surface. So they're not paying attention to the fact they've got all these peripheral machines just kind of hanging out there, these old WordPress blogs or whatever. And so I, as an attacker, have effectively infinite amount of time to do a really good reconnaissance and figure out what that company has. And then I can, if I have any exploit at all that matches anything in their infrastructure, I can feed it through the system in basically real time. As the exploit is appears on the internet, I'm now exploiting you. So it feels almost like it's coming, you know, like the person who invented it is the one who exploited us, because how did it happen that fast? But that's how it's happening. It's so fast. It looks as if the attacker already had the exploit. And there is really no defense related to patching that's going to work. You just cannot patch your way out of that problem. You have to have isolation. You have to assume that you're going to get breached, and assume that if you do get breached, that everything in that enclave is going to go with it. So you have to have sort of barriers between your data to make sure that if this thing gets compromised, this thing over here doesn't get compromised, and so on. And there's a bunch of other things like that. In fact, I talked with the guys who run the one of the WAF companies, one of the bigger ones, and I asked them, like, let's say I give you the patch at the exact same time I try to exploit it, who wins? And then they said, yeah, Robert, you know, it takes multiple seconds to update the backplane. And so even the WAF companies, the guys who, you know, do automatic patching or whatever, even they don't have a good defense against this. So it doesn't, any sort of active patching or anything like that, unless they can do it purely on an anomaly basis, as opposed to any sort of signature, it's very unlikely to survive the types of attacks that adversaries are going towards. And to speak to AI, since you mentioned it, just because I think it's kind of the elephant in the room and everyone's going to ask the question anyway, AI generally doesn't change things very much. We already had ways to do all these things before. So for the most part, it doesn't change things, with one, I think, very important exception in my world anyway, on the red team side. On the blue team side, there's a whole bunch of things it does. But on the red team side, what it really does is it speeds up the process of understanding what the attack surface looks like, sort of making decisions about what is theirs and not theirs. So that kind of speeds up the process from that perspective. It's kind of vaguely interesting, I guess. But really, it's that one day scenario. I have a new attack that comes in. I've never seen it before. I can have an AI system that can set up like a test bed, actually try the exploit, see if it all works, with a very high level of competency, higher than the average attacker for sure, and then feed it to the system I just talked about. So instead of it taking me, a human being, potentially like hours or days to figure out how this exploit works and giving the blue team time to patch, I can now do that entire process in a handful of seconds, you know, we'll call it, you know, 50 seconds, you know, a minute and a half or something, you know, not like, we're not talking hours here, and feed that into the system I just described. The chances of your system administrators being able to get to all those machines and patch it in a minute and a half is extremely low, basically zero. So I think that's the major thing, is it really just speeds up and improves the capabilities of the adversaries.
Big corporations, no offense, but are not really known for speed and fast transformation. Is it also something where you have to speed up by, you already talked about dual use, by collaborating with startups or also external consultants and experts like Robert or Manuel?
Absolutely. I think it's known that big corporations are normally tankers. To make them move a little bit, it takes hours and days, and, you know, yeah, we are not the fastest one. But of course, you need to have a very good ecosystem that is around you. Startups, people that know the industry really well, to be on top of things. And in my area especially, we need to do things, as Robert rightly said, in seconds. If Viasat, the satellite is down, by the way, it's then not when the jamming happens, it's the satellite, it's the modem. But if the modem is jammed, you know, you need fast solutions. And you see that in Ukraine, they have to do things really fast. They have to be resilient and put back up their defense. So we also need to we have even companies from outside, startups, trying to penetrate our system to see whether we have some weak spots to find that. Because yes, in a big corporation, you sometimes oversee things. So speed is of the essence. Swarm intelligence is of the essence. In this respect, we are on the blue forces and not on the red ones, but we like the red ones to attack us to see where do we have maybe parts where we need to do some patching. And the patchings need to be done really fast.
Manuel, in Germany, we are especially good in over-regulating and waiting for the right legislation, the right regulation before we are doing something or before we are able to actually do something. What would you say, what is the right balance between having everything set up or just trying it out to see how fast we can find a solution?
Well, at the end, it's always a balance that has to be discussed, but always with rights of civilians and keeping up and running a democracy. And it does not help if you do over-regulation, and it does not help if you say, well, critical infrastructures can do their own if they are big or small. Big ones are like a tanker, as Karen said, but do your own thing, we don't care. So, because the state has a responsibility for the civilians, and therefore it has also a responsibility to make good laws, good bureaucracy. Good bureaucracy means to keep some ability to act, but to make people and companies sure, and also the governmental infrastructures, that they are in this responsibility. And what we always see is that, for example, what Robert mentioned, that you have systems connected to the internet. I see many critical infrastructures and governmental infrastructures which operate archaeologically vulnerable systems, archaeologically interesting systems directly connected to the internet. You don't need AI. You don't need 0.2 seconds to compromise them. You can really slow beat, get to them, decide on 40 different real vulnerabilities to immediately take them over. So, and you are still successful. So if we discuss about good laws and good technologies and good approaches, you always result in a good resilience, which Karen mentioned, and that means you need good defense in processes, such as in an information security management system or business continuity management. But nevertheless, you must integrate security into processes and risk management and understanding risk into the culture of your whole company. And that results in some kind of fast resilience by living real defense. And we see, for example, in Ukraine, they are not the best ones in offensive methodologies, but they are really good in defense. And if something breaks, they can do incident response, get things fast up and running again, and having sometimes even analog backup strategy. And by this, the attackers cannot disrupt something on a long term. And now you have to mention that Putin realized this, and he sends rockets and bombs to the critical infrastructure, destroying them physically on a long term. But to address this, it means you must have a good diplomatic approach to address this. You must have a good cyber resilience strategy overall, and not only limited to the military or the government. You need it fully on every different area in your state, because IP packets don't care about some compliance or your scope was this or your responsibility was that. If you have a vulnerability, if you have a problem, if you have an archaeological system operated on the internet, it will be compromised and it will be a problem at the end. And you can take care of problems by resilience, and resilience means being able to address this properly. So even a tanker can say, yes, we are not good in patching immediately. However, we know how to detect an attack and we are able to respond in a proper way. Everyone wants to restore, but no one wants to do a backup. And being able to find out if the backup is restored in the right time. Everyone says, yeah, we must have passwords, and for remote access, we should use multi-factor authentication. But what I see in reality in critical infrastructures is you can even not smell the multi-factor authentication, but you can smell this old things operated still on the internet. And that is an issue we can address properly without having, you know, discussions about is AI the right solution for whatever. If we watch, for example, the AI discussion in this scenario, the fail rate in false positive and false negative is a big issue, and that seems to be ignored by all the marketing glitter hype if we discuss about AI. So what we don't have usually in AI discussions is technology impact assessments are not done. Collateral damage seems to be forgotten because of some kind of technology affiliation or technology trust and faith in technology. And you cannot solve social problems with technology. You need this in this security and defense, in the processes and in the mindset of the culture of your whole company or in your whole state. Otherwise, it does not work. And then you are quick enough to respond and to reduce the outcome and impact of an attack in a proper way.
Can I add something to that? Because I think you mentioned the government, and I think it is true. If we look, for example, to China, their GDP is going down. Nevertheless, they invest a significant amount of money in defense and in cyber. And who is looking in China for the past years, you know that they have in a system called the Five Stairs to Heaven, where they actually put every 5 years which industries they want to lead. And this is where they spent the money. If you look to Russia, they spent 6% of their GDP for defense. If I look to the US, and you know that better than I do, I think it's like $850 billion they're spending in defense. And then we have to look at our own country to say, how much are we spending on defense and cyber? So I think it's also that part where we need to have a look and be realistic. What can we afford with maybe 1.5% of our GDP or less?
Perfect bridge to the question I wanted to ask you. Because we talk a lot about Zeitenwende and that everything is changing now when it comes to the military and our military infrastructure. What is the amount of money that is like going into cyber in that whole discussion? Because like not the exact amount, but would you say they do that right? Or like at least there is a good setup between... I would call it like classic weapon systems. They are also very digital nowadays, but still, what is the balance here?
I think the government and also the armed forces realized that they have not spent enough money in that. And you could see that just earlier this month, there was a NATO practice called Keep Shield. And they tried to, you know, see how we can, you know, within the NATO countries, can you penetrate the systems? Can you check, do the C2 systems, are they affected? And how can you patch that? And it was realized that we're not doing such a good job across the NATO. So there's training needs to be done. And I think the armed forces have really understood they need to speed up there. And just looking at some figures also from Bitkom, I read somewhere that by 2040, Bitkom estimates that in Germany, 600,000, probably 660,000 IT specialists are missing. You know, we have to less people there. So how can we do cybersecurity really well in the defense, but also in the civilian area. If we are lacking this knowledge, you know, we are maybe not having enough people going through the university or through programs to actually be a cyber expert.
If as you mentioned, NATO locked shields, it is a good thing to mention that, because NATO locked shields shows every year that we have real deficits in securing, in defense, our critical infrastructure. So you can play, of course, military play games to show, we didn't invest enough in military security. But the reality is they show that we do not put enough efforts in real defense methodologies and processes in our critical infrastructures. Because if they are resilient in a real defensive way, you don't really need a lot of military efforts to be able to secure them in a proper way. And very often, if you also mention, like, we have two less IT experts, yes, of course, we have two less experts because we want to digitalize every single piece of crap you can imagine by doing an analog process, which was crappy, into a digital process, which remains crappy. The question, for example, in critical infrastructures is, do you really need the digitalization in this process? The only real answer, without playing golf or discussing about Jamba Wamba hipster hypes, is can we support and ensure that the civilization can be supported in this critical infrastructure doing, like freshwater, like energy, whatever, without automatization and in IT? If you can't answer this in a proper way, you need automatic processes, you need digitalization. Otherwise, you don't. And we see many areas where they say, we must now do IT, we must now do AI, we must do blockchain, whatever. And if I ask why in your critical infrastructure, everything works perfect in a good flow and you can do this for the next like 20, 30 years, then you have a lack of production and you need automatization. Why are you discussing this now? But everyone does AI and we need to do it also. But they do it with the lack of people and with the lack of knowledge. And then you have the same archaeological infrastructure we are discussing about being vulnerable. And you need more military invest to secure this. That's a wrong approach. But, you know, speaking about it and realizing it is two different things. I'm doing the first part. Others have to realize this. So that is my point on these two takes.
Robert, one final question to you. We already talked about science fiction scenarios and stuff like that. What is the thing you're actually most afraid of in that whole setup right now?
Well, I think we pretty much already covered it. So I'll just add my two cents to the previous statements, and I think that'll answer both questions at the same time. When I did some work with the Pentagon, and they have a Hack the Pentagon program. So they invited a bunch of hackers to go and break in and stuff. And so me and one other guy actually did succeed. And as a part of that, we basically handed off what we knew about the Pentagon. And I was taking a very Chinese-centric approach of hacking them. So massive amounts of reconnaissance performed over a long period of time. Across their entire infrastructure. And they thought that I'd find about 100,000 assets. The target was only 31 assets, but they thought I'd find about 100,000 assets. By the end of my first test, I found 1.9 million assets that were on the public internet. And now we're up to more like 5 million. And there's just no way they can secure all 5 million machines. Like, you just can't do it. It's not possible. Like, if you said there's 50 machines, I'd say that's pretty hard. And then on top of that, that's not them. I mean, that's just one way of looking at them. Another way of looking at them is all their civilian contractors. And there's just so many more of them, and their infrastructure is just so much even greater and even more poorly understood and poorly documented and poorly protected. And it just kind of goes from there, and their contractors, and you just keep going down the attack chain. And I think that's actually the thing that keeps me up at night is, there's really no one, and I truly mean this, there's literally no one actually looking at that problem. I mean, individuals will look at parts of it, but When you go down to the state level, for instance, as opposed to the national level, I know for a fact, like, no one's paying attention to the dog catcher's website. You know, Sim's nephew or something created it. And, you know, if there's a back channel into some subsystem and that thing breaks into a bigger subsystem and suddenly they have access to all kinds of crazy things, that's just how it's built. And there's really no way to know for a fact that that's happening. One of the things I told CISA, and they didn't laugh, but they said it's impossible. As I said, if I were you guys, I would say, just go and tell all the states, you're going to withhold federal funding, unless you guys can give us a count, just a number of how many assets you have. And then the subsequent year, you have to justify what that number was. And then the subsequent year, you have to tell us what's running on it. The subsequent year, then you have to justify why you have any vulnerabilities at all that you haven't already mitigated. So that gives them multiple years to get their ducks in a row. And even if the number is a swag, at least now they know that that swag's not going to work. It gives them a couple of cycles to get the budgeting together, to get the subcontractors in place and actually start thinking about this problem for real, or do it themselves. I don't really care if it's inside or outside, it just gets done. And they're like, Robert, that's never going to happen. We're never going to do that. And that is the thing that really keeps me up at night, because that is how the Chinese are thinking about it. That's how guys like I think about it. I already have subsystems that I've built that are capable of finding all those assets and finding vulnerabilities on them and breaking into them if I feel like it. And so thinking that nation states aren't doing the same thing is ridiculous.
Thank you so much for joining us virtually and joining us in person here. We are switching right to the next panel, but thank you for the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.